Welcome to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. I'm Steve Alexander, in for Orion Samuelson this week. Joining us in just a few minutes will be Max Armstrong with an interview about the agricultural commodities. And coming up momentarily, Diane Swonk, a financial markets expert, to talk about what went on Wall Street this week. Let's see what happened today. The Dow was down 18 points at 18,144. For the week, the Dow was up 0.04%. The S&P 500 was down a half a point on Friday at 2,141. For the week, the S&P 500 was up 0.4%. And the NASDAQ on Friday was up 14.5 points at 5,256. For the week, the NASDAQ was up 0.8%. Agricultural commodities. December corn gained a penny and a half at 352.5 a bushel. For the week, corn was down 0.8%. Soybeans gained 8.5 cents on Friday to 984 a bushel. And for the week, a third straight week of gains. Soy was up 2.2%. And wheat was down 1.6% for the week, closing on Friday at 414.5 a bushel, down 2.5 cents. Joining me on the telephone is my guest, Diane Swonk of Diane Swonk Economics in Chicago. Diane is one of the most sought-after economists in the world who advises central banks and multinational companies. She has a long and very impressive resume, which you can see at DianeSwonk.com. That's Diane, S-W-O-N-K.com. Thank you for joining us, Diane. Another eventful week on Wall Street.
Certainly has been. It seems like we're going to have a lot of eventful weeks to come as well.
Yeah, earnings certainly was part of the story this week. What did you see in earnings that you liked or didn't like?
Well, we're seeing earnings come back a bit off of low levels. The financial sector is surprising on the upside. Certainly we saw Microsoft do extremely well. But in general, the real issue is, you know, we've been through a period where we've had very weak growth and margins are compressing after going to record highs. And the question is, going forward, what's going to support the stock market? Are earnings going to come back, or is going to be continual push to issue dividends and do stock buybacks, which, you know, certainly help investors in the near term, but my concern over the longer haul is that that shift towards that kind of focus as opposed to investment is undermining the foundation for growth going forward for these companies as well as the overall economy.
Where does the Fed enter into this? I saw that after the market, before the market closed, John Williams of the San Francisco Fed had a few comments. What are traders looking for from the Fed?
Well, the key issue is not November, but December. The November meeting is just a few days before the election, and although the Fed tries to stay apolitical, it would actually, they're in a catch-22 that if they did anything in November, it would disrupt markets because they're not pricing it in, and so it would look political, and if they do anything, it would look political, and by default, they're going to punt. What's really important is what we've seen is even though Chair Yellen would like to hold off on raising interest rates, the majority of the people at the September meeting were ready to pull the trigger and raise rates in September. And depending on how things unfold over the next couple of employment reports and the data we see, I think it's going to be very difficult, short of a revolt within the Fed, for Chair Yellen to delay again in December. The Fed is likely to raise rates again in December. Once a year, Yellen, she will raise rates again. And we saw that this week not only with some of the people that you don't usually see it with, like Williams, but also Dudley, most importantly. He's the the president of the New York Fed. And it's very important to look at his view because he never dissents from the chair, but he does have a vote always. He's the only president that can always vote on which way interest rates are going, and he's basically ready to raise rates in December.
This has been an issue that's been going on for, it seems, forever, but I'm wondering, why hasn't the market already built in some of the movement based on what the Fed may or may not do, or has it?
Yeah, this is a really interesting issue, and it's that, frankly, the markets have been more right than the Fed. The markets have not expected the Fed to move very aggressively. There's about a 60-70% chance priced in the move in December, which I think is fair and good, but in large part, the Fed has not been able to move as aggressively as it hoped, which is sort of fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me, and the markets have sort of it's undermined the Fed's credibility in their communications. And having the Fed chair sort of overrule the majority of people in the room, not the biggest votes in the room, but the majority of people in the room in September, you know, tells you just how divided this Fed is. And I think it isn't helping in terms of clarification. But at the end of the day, who's been right, the Fed or the markets, in terms of projecting what the Fed's going to do? The markets have been much more right than the Federal Reserve.
Can we talk about mergers and acquisitions?
Sure.
On Friday, AT&T and Time Warner were rumored to have been in advanced discussions about some sort of merger and or acquisition. Time Warner benefited from that in the stock trading. But has this been a good year for M&As?
Well, M&A activity sort of has had its, you know, bits and it's been moving in fits and starts. And I think what we're seeing is there's the good news on M&A where people are looking to they don't know how to move forward organically and grow organically, so they're looking for strategic alliances to grow. And stock prices are lofty enough that that gives them money to do it. Of course, their acquirers who they're acquiring are also expensive. On the other side of it, there's enormous amount of global uncertainty, and I think that's going to complicate the mergers and acquisition market. There's a lot of opportunity out there with things like the Brexit vote, our own elections. It creates opportunities, but also creates landmines in the road ahead, and I think that's going to be a bit of a problem going forward as people try to figure out what are the best strategic alliances to have. How is who they're aligning up with going to be? How are they going to be affected by the global economic environment, and what will companies want to hedge against or try to exploit in this very rapidly changing global economic environment? What was once a move towards sort of, you know, economic cooperation, political cooperation, defined the entire post-World War II era, we're now seeing enormous backlash to that. It's not just in the United States. It's really across much of the Western world. In Europe, the Brexit vote was a symptom of an illness that ails a larger part of the Western world economies, and that's going to have some ripple effects in terms of how these mergers and acquisitions are looked at going forward. And I think that's really key, is the uncertainty that's creeping into the equation.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about Brexit and what is likely to happen there with the United Kingdom after the exit, I guess, if it happens.
Well, you know, that's if it happens, it's uncertainty. And I think one of the biggest mistakes about when we see these kinds of votes, it can have very large negative implications, but it was a vote, not an action. And immediately you saw the Bank of England and the British government come out and say, we're going to offset it with stimulus, promises of stimulus. And so when the dust cleared, consumers continued to spend, the pound depreciated, exports picked up, tourism picked up, companies that were exporting from the UK picked up their production. But the more corrosive issue is that investment was shelved. People, the uncertainty about what's next, what kind of exit this will be, hard or soft. Will it have a lot more hurdles to trade for the UK? Will it have a lot more hurdles to immigration for the UK, which may mean many of the top talent in their version of Silicon Valley exit the UK, which changes the value of those companies? A lot of moving parts. And I think the greatest mistake that we see happening in this sort of backlash to globalization and technology that we're seeing going on right now is the establishment saying there's going to be a cataclysmic outcome. The reality is it's more corrosive in nature, and the fact that something doesn't happen immediately because of all the uncertainty surrounding a vote as opposed to an actual action is that then it further undermines trust in establishment and the existing, you know, status quo. And I think that's where the real risk is that you get sort of people thinking, well, it doesn't have any negative effects, it's okay. It does have huge potential negative effects, but as you said, it was a vote, and there's a lot of uncertainty about it. We just don't know how they're going to handle it. Right now, it's not looking great. I happen to be in London during the flash crash in the pound, which was good for me being there to be able to buy more, but not good for the UK. And I think that's, you know, you're really going to see a lot of volatility as the uncertainty unfolds.
Speaking of uncertainty, our elections are near. Has Wall Street built in a response one way or the other as to how things are going to turn out?
They have, and, you know, it's a little bit worrisome because if things don't turn out as they expect, that could really roil financial markets. The current Wall Street sort of bet, the implicit bet in Wall Street, is what we call moderate Clinton victory, where Clinton wins, maybe the Senate goes Democrat, and the House stays Republican. You get an odd bedfellows in that situation, where Chuck Schumer and Paul Ryan both have incentives to cut deals. They are deal makers. Paul Ryan looking at 2020. And we actually could see some movement forward on corporate tax reform and infrastructure investment without the extremes of the two parties dominating the equation. And that sort of, from Wall Street's perspective, they see it as an extension of the status quo. Actually, there could be some positive things move forward. We also have a debt ceiling we need to lift in March, which could be a real test in the wake of the elections for whoever is president. What has not been priced in is a landslide Clinton victory where the Senate and the House move Democrat. That's highly unlikely in the House, but I think it's important to understand that that would be, from Wall Street's perspective, they like having a split government. They like having what they see as checks and balances in Washington, and they would react negatively to that. Equally, if not more negative, would be a Trump victory because of the uncertainty of the man and what it would mean. He doesn't have his transition team. It's sort of non-existent. People don't know who would be in power. And these are things that uncertainty is the enemy of Wall Street. And regardless of what policies he may or may not implement, most economists agree they would be more detrimental than a Clinton leadership in the presidency, depending on the breakdown of the Senate and the House. I think it's important that Wall Street has sort of priced in the best case scenario for them. And there's a lot of room on both sides of the extremes of that equation to get surprised, and surprise means volatility and really roiling financial markets. The other important issue is that November 8th will not resolve uncertainty in terms of policy in Washington. Coming in March, we have to lift the debt ceiling. John Boehner, when he was Speaker of the House, he lifted the debt ceiling by reaching across the aisle and getting more Democrats to vote for it than Republicans. It passed quickly, and then he left quickly. And that will be a real challenge for Paul Ryan to try to get an agreement that keeps him in power so that he can do what he needs to do from the House side. And so these are a lot of uncertainty that's coming up right after whoever the next president is inaugurated into office. The most important issue here is to understand that, you know, we are in a situation where whether it's good policy or bad policy, it takes time to work. And unfortunately, the good news is I actually think we're going to move forward on some good policies, and that's corporate tax reform, infrastructure investment. We all know these are needed. The bad news is once Congress turns a spigot on, it's difficult to turn it off, and we're already at a high debt-to-GDP ratio. Deficits had been falling in recent years, but has moved back into the red ink as a share of GDP this year. And without dealing with our longer-term issues and getting into doing stimulus within the context of fiscal sustainability, I worry about what that means over the long term. And, you know, no matter who wins on November 8th, I don't have a lot of faith that anyone in Washington is going to be really good at figuring that out and being preemptive about it.
Diane Swonk of DS Economics in Chicago. You can see all about her company at dianeswonk.com. Diane, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
Brian Splitt from Allendale Incorporated came calling this week, and we had the chance to talk a bit about how we're doing with the harvest, how the market is handling it all, etc. Harvest is right on pace with normal, isn't it, Brian?
We've got a really good pace going right now, and we expect a rather aggressive pace to continue. There doesn't seem to be any major weather problems to be seen in North America. And really, if there are any slowdowns, it would just be maybe some rain up in Ontario, but not here domestically. So pace is looking great, and we're going to have a really strong finish to harvest, it looks like.
Let's do a little bit of yield conjecture here for just a moment. And, of course, it's not all conjecture. I mean, we've had some good, solid data from crop reports. Is it your feeling, as we take a look at what is happening with the corn harvest, that that number is yet to come down some? Many analysts are of that opinion.
Yeah, and I think I can agree with that, although I would say that we shouldn't get too excited about the yield coming down materially. And we also have to realize that with the projected carryout levels, even after the last yield reduction, that it's going to take a rather aggressive yield reduction to get carryout down substantially, where it's going to mean a major difference to the prices.
It would have to be something under, what, 170 bushels? And we're not likely to drop under that, are we?
No, I don't think so. And heck, if you take the yield down to, let's just say, 170.4 from the previous estimate we had in September of 74.4, 4 bushels an acre is going to be maybe about 365 million bushels. And the way the USDA will manage balance sheets, they don't take that whole production loss off the top of carryout. It's going to be maybe rule of thumb about half that. So even if it was, let's say, 200 million bushels that they lopped right off of carryout, we're still at a 2-1 plus carryout. And that is still going to be, you know, a 400 million bushel difference from about this time last year. So I think it's not likely to see the same levels achieved for our fall-winter high this year that we did see last year.
What happened with all of that crop tour talk about quality problems that we had back in the month of August after the August crop report came out and ahead of the September report? All of that chatter about problems out there on those ears of corn, is that yet to be accounted for?
Well, I think that's part of the yield coming down slightly, you know, and there's been little issues here and there, some diplodian and some other things. But, you know, maybe if we do have a little bit lighter test weight this year, these are things that will come out as we get into some of the quarterly stock reports down the road. So once we get maybe to January and we say, all right, during the first quarter usage, we used a little bit more than we thought, and that might be due to some of these issues that we're addressing right now. But the USDA won't address that on these monthly reports. That'll come out on a quarterly stock report when all of a sudden it looks like there's bushels gone. And it's because we're using more of it faster, because it takes more of lower test weight, lower quality corn to do the same job.
So as we've seen in the past, even after a November crop report, which, by the way, comes out on the 9th, the day after the presidential election, and even after the, quote, final numbers are posted in January for the year, we sometimes still see those numbers from the crop of the year before coming into play, coming into some adjustment.
Right, and the USDA does reserve the right to adjust a previous year's crop. We see that especially in soybeans, where typically in a September quarterly report, they'll go back and they'll adjust the previous year's crop. And, you know, these guys have a three-dimensional chess game that they are playing, and they're doing their best to estimate where stocks will be quite a distance out in the future. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of categories that they have wiggle room to adjust. But, you know, it's always a work in progress month to month and year to year.
You mentioned soybeans. Let's talk about the yield there. The feeling is it could be inching up a little bit more. Many analysts are of that opinion anyway. Do you share that view?
Well, from talking to producers, it seems between the two crops that the soybean crop is definitely the one that is continuing to outperform, although maybe recently some of the later beans may not be seeing the extreme yield results that the early planted beans are. But either way, we are seeing a record crop. This would be our third record soybean crop in a row domestically. And we've got, 4 or 5 record crops in a row in Brazil. And I think it's pretty incredible that we are seeing these record crops year after year and you know, hemisphere to hemisphere, and yet the world stocks to use for soybeans has come down 2 years in a row, and our world stocks to use for vegetable oils has been coming down for about the past 5 years in a row. And that's why this bean oil market is such an integral part to maintaining strength in the soybean market, even despite these rather large yield reports.
You know, it is interesting, and you talk about these successive yield increases in soybeans. It wasn't that many years ago that we had plateaued on the soybean yield. We were not making significant gains. I mean, it was just kind of hanging in there in that, what, mid 40 to upper 40 bushel range.
Right. And I think the drought in 2012 went a long way to providing additional investment in seed technology for both corn and for soybeans. And I believe that that additional investment has led to an improvement in yield potential for both crops and have brought both to a new plateau in yield potential.
That investment hasn't only taken place in the United States and South America, but some other countries, and I think, for example, of Ukraine. That part of the world has become a big player once again in a different way than it was before, it seems. I mean, I think of the huge buying that took place by the old Soviet Union 40 years ago. Now that's a part of the world that's a major competitor with us, for example, in wheat production, I think.
Right, and the Black Sea region as a whole has become a major competitor in grain production. And one of the things that we also have to realize is that domestically, the American producer is above and beyond all the producers throughout the rest of the world. So the technology that we're using, and there's a lot of catch-up work to be done. And I think that that also speaks to the other side of the argument that, yes, the human population around the globe is growing year after year after year. But we've got a lot of strides to make in agricultural technology through the rest of the world that we could see that production increase as well as the population increases.
Brian, you're on the phone a lot with producers, I know. You interact with them on the social media. You talk to them a lot. I've been hearing quite a bit of concern expressed by bankers and economists about this winter ahead and about how these farm balance sheets are looking and about some of the pressures that may come to play. What's your sense of how that is looking and how it might impact the planting season ahead, if at all?
Well, there's been speculation, and it seems like for the past 2 years, that the bankers may tighten the purse strings a little bit and force producers into a little bit more aggressive soybean planting because the input costs are less, so it doesn't require the same investment. But also it does not provide the same potential return with the extra bushels that we've been seeing with corn production. Whether or not that comes to fruition this year, I don't know. But it does seem that the concern from the banker side is growing. And if anything, it might require the bankers scrutinizing balance sheets a little heavier from producer to producer. And so as we get into the acreage mix up for next year, you know, we have to consider that we're not very far off the December 17 contract at this time to where the D16 contract was this time last year. So with prices near $4, and if we see corn continue to gain in the short term, I suspect there could be another acreage problem next year where we just have too many acres, and that will leave it very difficult to get a really good shot at marketing at higher prices. So it might be a similar setup to the last 2 years where you get one shot during summer, and that shot might be there for a week or two, and then it's gone.
That means the grower must stay on top of the market or have someone such as yourself who does so.
Right, and staying on top of the market is not just the futures market. I think there's other components of the market that are very important to pay attention to, and so one would be your local basis. I encourage producers to keep a little notebook and at the very least check in on basis offerings once a week.
Yeah, you know, that can fluctuate greatly over, and it can be a wide variety of factors. Frozen rivers, for example, might affect that for some of our producers.
Absolutely, and I've learned from what I consider to be some very successful marketers that there are opportunities and you really have to keep your eyes and ears open. But for example, you might have a severe storm on the horizon and your local basis may improve by 5 to 10 cents just because that facility wants to make sure that they have their needs covered for that short period of time. So if you're not paying attention, you might be missing an opportunity. And I would think that where prices are currently, you know, a 10-cent opportunity is something that needs to be seized if it's there.
Brian, it's always good to sit down and visit with you. We sure appreciate it.
Thank you, Max.
For more than 150 years, CME Group has been built with your confidence. Without it, we simply wouldn't be in business. Today, we continue to work on new and better ways to protect you and grow your confidence in the markets. After all, it's our vigilance that brings you the peace of mind you need today and in the future. CME Group. Advance with confidence.
You are listening to The Markets, sponsored by the CME Group. I'm Steve Alexander in for Orion Samuelson, and let's take a look at energy prices. Oil prices settled slightly higher on Friday, putting up a fifth straight weekly gain for U.S. crude, as bullish comments from Russia contended with a resurgent dollar and a rising oil rig count. U.S. West Texas Intermediate, the Texas T, settled up 22 cents at $50.85 a barrel, closing the week up 1%. Global benchmark Brent crude futures rose 42 cents to $51.80 a barrel. The contract was down about 0.3% for the week. A closely watched report from oil services company Baker Hughes showed the number of active U.S. oil rigs rose by 11 this week. That is the 17th week without a decline in the rig count. Some traders and analysts have warned for weeks that shale oil drillers, responsible for much of the worldwide crude glut of the past 2 years, were likely to ramp up activity again, with WTI back at above $50 from 12-year lows of around $26 in February. And that's when all of the drilling activity came to a standstill. Taking a look at gold futures, they were up 1.4% for the week, but over the last 3 weeks, gold has been off 6.6%. Recapping the Wall Street market activity, stocks closed mostly flat on Friday amid a strong dollar, and as earnings season continued, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down about 15 points after momentarily trading higher, with IBM contributing the most losses, offsetting gains from McDonald's and Microsoft. And it was another volatile day on Wall Street, with the Dow down 112.5 points at one time. The S&P 500 ended around break-even after holding lower for most of the session, with consumer discretionary leading advancers. Consumer discretionary stocks were led by Time Warner, which rose 7.8% amid reports the company has engaged in talks for a deal to be bought out by AT&T. AT&T shares were down about 3%. The NASDAQ composite outperformed, rising 0.3% after Microsoft hit a new all-time high. For the week, the three major indices notched slight gains. Stocks have held recently in a tight range, with the S&P 500 having moved just 1.1% over the past 3 months. The U.S. dollar rose approximately a third of a percent against a basket of currencies, hitting a seven-month high. The euro fell nearly a half percent to $1.08.5 against the greenback, while the Chinese yuan hit its lowest level against the U.S. currency dating back to 2010. Coming up next week, data from the U.S. Commerce Department is expected to show that gross domestic product probably increased at a 2.5% annual rate in the third quarter. GDP expanded at a 1.4% annual rate in the second quarter. On Tuesday, the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller Composite Index of 20 metropolitan areas is expected to show a 5.1% increase in August on a year-over-year basis. The Conference Board will issue consumer confidence figures for October on Tuesday. Apple reports fourth quarter results on Tuesday, and Alphabet Google reports third quarter earnings on Thursday. Amazon reports third quarter results on Thursday as well. ExxonMobil, the world's largest publicly traded oil producer, is expected to report a third quarter profit on Friday. Coca-Cola will release its third quarter results on Wednesday. Friday, MasterCard reports its third-quarter financial results. Drug maker Merck & Company is expected to report higher earnings on Tuesday. Mondelez International is expected to report third-quarter earnings on Wednesday. Sales of the maker of Oreo cookies and Cadbury chocolates is likely to slow as consumers shift to healthier snacks. And it is also facing competition from rival Hershey. DuPont is expected to report a higher third-quarter profit as the company stepped up its cost-saving efforts. And Dow Chemical is expected to report a slightly larger third-quarter revenue on Thursday. Procter & Gamble reports on Tuesday. Amgen reports third-quarter earnings on Thursday. General Motors on Tuesday will tell us its third-quarter earnings. Ford Motor Company releases its third-quarter earnings on Thursday. Caterpillar will report its third-quarter earnings on Tuesday before the market opens. AbbVie Incorporated, which is looking to reduce its dependence on its $8 billion a year arthritis drug Humira, is expected to report third quarter earnings and revenue on Friday. AT&T reports on Tuesday. LinkedIn reports on Thursday. We're expecting a rise in revenue. Twitter will report its results on Thursday. And there are many more companies reporting earnings next week. That's a look at the markets for this week, sponsored by the CME Group. For Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong, I'm Steve Alexander.